it's in the breaking, we come unbound. And it's in the giving, we are found. Yeah, you can barely change.
Welcome to A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, a podcast dedicated to the telling of authentic stories and the sharing of insightful wisdom, exploring science and spirituality, medicine and Mother Nature. No topic is off limits when it comes to growing our personal understanding and supporting our collective well-being. With your host, Dr. Rob Abbott, a family medicine resident practicing spiritually focused and evolutionarily informed functional medicine, we hope to nourish your being so that you can flourish in whatever the moment has called for you to do.
And I know you try.
In episode 32 of A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, I welcome back visionary researcher and the man behind the magnesium advocacy group, Morley Robbins. From start to finish, this conversation is another whirlwind of mineral metabolism, our second dive into the fascinating world of magnesium, iron, and copper. In this particular conversation, Morley quickly gets us back up to speed on iron and its primary role in the body as the structural center of the oxygen-carrying molecule, hemoglobin, and then quickly pushes us forward into a fascinating exploration of blood and the red blood cell. What do we mean when we say blood? How many red blood cells do we really have? Where do they come from, and what is their primary role? And where does iron and oxidative stress enter the picture? We then discuss a surprising discovery by Morley, an iron metabolism and pathology module from my very own medical school. Together, we deconstruct what I was taught as a second-year medical student, and perhaps fill in the gaps for the pieces of the story that were missing from my education. Morley then leads us into a discussion of the reticuloendothelial system and the life cycle of a red blood cell. What role does iron and magnesium play in the function and shape of our red blood cells? Are our cells living as long as they should? What can we learn from sickle cell anemia and other disorders of the red blood cell membrane when it comes to iron and magnesium metabolism? Changing gears, Morley gives us a wonderful description of our primary energy production system, the electron transport chain, the role of reactive oxygen scavengers and antioxidants, and the interplay of copper and magnesium to produce energy and ultimately protect us from free radical damage. We end the discussion with a little thought experiment, exploring the implications of iron fortification, comparing the amounts and forms of iron found in animal foods versus fortified cereals. We trace the journey of excessive and poorly absorbed iron into our colons, exploring the resulting gut dysbiosis and immune activation that can ensue from this excessive oxidative load. Morley gives us hope at the end of the podcast, however, as he describes his food-based root cause protocol, designed to restore the intricate balance of these minerals in our bodies. Morley's curiosity is unparalleled, and I am thankful for his desire to research ideas at the edge of science, and then share his findings with us all. I encourage you to spend a few moments with this conversation, as you will likely need to listen maybe 2, 3, or even 4 times to pick up all the insights and wisdom discussed. And lastly, if you enjoyed this conversation, we would really appreciate it if you would take 2 minutes to leave a review in iTunes, so more people can find our podcast and its curious explorations. And with that, let's dig into the show. Well, Morley, thank you so much for coming back on the show for a part two of what may end up being, you know, part 7, 8, 9, and 10. But so thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to have another conversation. So I think we, you know, Really, I hope listeners enjoyed the first part of this conversation in episode 23. We'll certainly have a link for people to, if they haven't heard that yet, to go back and listen to the first part. We're going to attempt to have a kind of continuation of that conversation in this discussion, but wanted to have you at least give us maybe a brief recap of what we addressed, and if there was anything new that's actually come up since that last conversation that really has just blown your mind.
Yeah, actually, you know, every day is a complete revelation. I think just to recap for the listeners, again, I'm a hospital executive who's a pre-med retread, and did that for 30-some years, and then discovered the amazing world of minerals about 9 years ago. And over the course of 9 years, I've been researching on a daily basis, 7 days a week, spend 2 to 3 hours a day reading journals, just trying to discover why is everybody so sick. And what I think will surprise people is that I've zeroed in on three minerals that need to be in balance. We need more magnesium, we need more bioavailable copper, and we need less iron. And that flies in the face of a lot of training and belief systems and what have you. No doubt we talked about that in the first session. But the importance of those three minerals and all the enzymes that they are responsible for begin to give credence to the priority. And just to give people a sense of order of magnitude, in a healthy body, you need around 90 milligrams of copper. That's not very much. You need 5,000 milligrams of iron. And you need 355,000 milligrams of magnesium. So what do you have? You have a 60-to-1 ratio iron to copper. And you have about a 70-to-1 ratio of magnesium to iron. And everything's cool when those ratios are where they're supposed to be. The train starts to come off the track when you start to lose those ratios and start to lose those minerals. And what I've come to realize is that the most vulnerable part of that triumvirate is with copper, because you only need 90. So if you take 10% away and you get it down to 80, suddenly the systems start to get really wonky really fast. And when you start to take away 10% copper and start to add in extra iron here, there, and everywhere, then the system really starts to fall apart. And the significance of the 95,000 and 355,000 is copper's really smart, magnesium's really important, and iron is really toxic, because it can destabilize the 90 and the 355. And that's a very different way of thinking about those three minerals. But I think the significance is built into what I call my root cause protocol, and people can find that on my website, thegotmag.org. And I've also got a new website, Rob, where it's devoted entirely to the root cause protocol, and it's called therootcauseprotocol.com. And then if people are so inclined, people are invited to purchase the 4.5 hours of video where I'm talking to one of your colleagues, Dr. Ben Edwards, who's a family practitioner over in Lubbock, Texas. And he's kind of like my straight man. I go into all the literature and science, and then he dumbs it down so the audience understands what he's saying. And I'm hoping at some point you two get to connect, because I think you're really going to enjoy each other's company. You're just a younger, leaner, meaner version of Ben Edwards. he's just a great guy, smart as a whip, and he's in his early 40s, and so he's got a few years on you, but he really is very excited about this whole approach. And he's got his whole medical team focusing on this. So that's kind of a quick recap of where we were. And I think what prompted this second round of discussion was I happened upon one of your training modules in at the University of Virginia Medical School, School of Medicine. I want to get that right. But it's about iron metabolism, and I just about fell out of my chair because first of all, it was your alma mater, but I was kind of surprised by what was missing, and thought we could use that as a basis for some discussion today because I think there's a lot of confusion about these three minerals, but just between copper and iron alone, it's mind-boggling how everything is upside down and backwards. So that's kind of where I thought we could go.
Yes, I almost as well fell out of my chair, or at least I'm usually standing at my desk. So I almost fell on the ground when I saw the email that you sent with a link to that module from the sort of first portion, my preclinical year curriculum at the University of Virginia, and you know, was instantly taken back to my apartment, my room, where I was reading through that document and doing some incredible calculations myself and just processing the implications of that material. So yes, that was quite a shock, but I thought too that it would be a perfect place to discuss, because we've talked a little bit in abstract about, you know, medical education and what students are getting. And this is, you know, concretely exactly what we were given. Now there's some other things that I actually have also saved. I have on my computer now that sort of dovetail with the specific module that you sent me and you described. But I was just, you know, when you sent that, I thought that was the perfect place to start our discussion. And, you know, to give people context, we'll actually can provide the link because it's freely available. So we'll have the link for folks to, so they can, you know, while listening to this, if they want to, you know, follow along or look. It basically, the document kind of goes through iron metabolism. It kind of gives the life story of iron from ingestion to absorption and what is iron's main purpose? And, you know, to give some perspective, we were talking about this before the show. This portion of the curriculum, interestingly enough, at my school, the preclinical years traditionally were 2 years, sort of a you know, August to May for 1 year and a subsequent August to May before starting rotations in the hospital. About 4 or 5 years ago, or maybe even more than that, like 5, 6 years ago, they restructured the curriculum to actually condense down those scientific years into 18 months. And it incorporated much more sort of adaptive learning and group learning. And so the schedule went from sort of that first year stayed kind of early August to late May, a couple months off in the summer. And then we came back in August and went all the way until the end of December and then had some time off in January to study for our first big board exam. And so interestingly, this module, the hematology and sort of oncology module, was the last 4 weeks of our curriculum, kind of after around Thanksgiving and into December, where everyone in my class, whether they wanted to admit it or not, was paying attention to something other than this material, because let's just say there was probably the biggest test the biggest test in sort of that early medical school career was looming on the horizon. So people's attention was looking elsewhere. I, however, had, you know, tried to do quite a bit of adaptive learning and really didn't actually spend that much time at the end focused on just studying for that test. So I actually was pretty open-minded at that point. Now, I will say I had no real great knowledge of the symphony, the orchestration of iron with copper and magnesium at that time. And this specific module, which we'll kind of go into, was a little bit lacking in having copper and magnesium discussed along with the role of iron. So that was a big, long ramble, basically to say, look, this did not get emphasized and students were not paying attention to it. And even if they were, there was a lot missing. So I wanted you to start us off with, and you've talked about this in other shows, but really, you know, what is the major player in the body in terms of our requirement for iron and where it goes?
Yeah. Okay. So the biggest requirement for iron is in hemoglobin. 70% of the body's iron is tied up in hemoglobin. And what's that doing? It's carrying oxygen. Hemoglobin is carrying oxygen in the red blood cells. So just to give you some numbers to play with, because I know you love numbers, they're between 20 and 30 trillion red blood cells in the average human body. That's a lot of red blood cells. And in one small drop of blood, which is a cubic millimeter of blood, just a little tiny drop, there's between 4 and 5 million red blood cells. So it's amazing when you think about these numbers. Well, why is that important? Because red blood cells account for 84% of all cells in the human body. I'll let that sink in. So we're basically red blood cells.
Yeah. You know, we had talked before, I'm sorry to interrupt. We had talked before that statistic of people that have heard commonly of, we're more bacteria than we are, you know, our own cells, these ratios of gut microbes to human cells. But interestingly, if you actually account for these red blood cells, you know, because they're such a staggering amount, we are closer to 1-to-1 to 2-to-1, you know, bacteria to us. It's when you forget about these red blood cells, which I'm not sure why you would, because it's a staggering, you know, amount of our body. That's when you get into those numbers that are commonly thrown out of 10-to-1 bacteria to us.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, the red blood cell is, Jerry Tennant is a physician over in Dallas. He wrote a really important book called Healing is Voltage. You would actually love that book when you have a moment, Rob. But he got very sick. He went to Yale Medical School. He did a lot of work in ophthalmology. He's the guy that perfected the laser technology that's used in ophthalmology. He's the guy, Jerry Tennant. And he got sick from that procedure because viruses were migrating up into his eyes. And for about 7 years, he was basically bedridden. But his whole focus was, if I can get one cell to work properly, I can get them all to work. And he spent years trying to figure out how does one cell work. Even though he'd been to Yale Medical School, he had to completely teach himself how it worked. And the thing is, the red blood cell is really important because physiologically, it's a powerhouse. And inside each red blood cell are about 250 million hemoglobin. Wow, that's a lot of hemoglobin. And so what's a hemoglobin? It's a molecule that has four heme groups. And what's in a heme group? It's at the center is iron, and that's where all that iron is hanging out. But what I think is mind-blowing is that the red blood cell is actually considered connective tissue because it's made in the bone marrow.
Correct.
It's not blood. It's actually connective tissue. It's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And the thing is, what you were alluding to earlier is the life cycle of iron, because it needs to be recycled in the body. And how long are these red blood cells supposed to live? Well, ideally, they're supposed to live 120 days. That's if everything's perfect. But they don't live that long anymore. And what the studies are very clear about is that when there is known magnesium deficiency and or copper deficiency, the red blood cell lifespan collapses 80%, and it only lasts about 20 days. That's a staggering change in the viability of the most important cell in the body. Why is that important? Because there's monocytes called macrophages. Those are the Pac-Men inside the body that have got to gobble up these dying red blood cells because they're part of what's called the reticuloendothelial system, which is the most absurd name on the planet for what it does. Basically, a recycling system.
Exactly.
That's all it is. RES is called reticuloendothelial system. Well, I just renamed it the recycling system. And what happens is when the lifespan goes from 120 days down to 20 days. It's suddenly, if you've ever seen the skit with Lucille Ball and Ethel, where they're at the chocolate factory and the supervisor says, "Speed it up, boys." And it's like suddenly they're stuffing chocolates all over their body because they're coming out so fast. Well, that's what's happening to the macrophages. They're getting stuffed with iron and they become iron laden. And that is considered the origin of all autoimmunity, is these iron laden macrophages that can't offload the iron. Why can't they offload the iron? Because they don't have the copper-based enzyme ferrooxidase working because they've got so much iron. And this is not my thinking. This is the thinking of Nancy Andrews, who was formerly the dean of medical school at Duke, down the street from you, and Rebecca King at Mayo Clinic, and Marianne Resnick up at Harvard School of Public Health. These are some of the leading minds on iron metabolism on the planet saying, oh my gosh, this recycling system is causing the autoimmunity that's behind about anywhere between 30 and 100 different conditions. Diabetes is considered autoimmune. Hashimoto's autoimmune. Renault's autoimmune. Multiple sclerosis, autoimmune. It's like the system is breaking down because there isn't adequate capacity to deal with the iron in our body.
Yeah.
The reason why I balked at your pathology thread on iron metabolism, the first thing is, as you noted, there's no mention of copper or magnesium, which is a bozo no-no. You can't, again, what we're supposed to believe, like circus bears, is that iron regulates itself. It doesn't regulate itself. It's a heavy metal to begin with. People get all worked up about mercury and aluminum, things like that. Well, trust me, iron is a heavy metal too, and it's very toxic. But what I found particularly entertaining was this idea that there's 3,600 milligrams of total body iron. Well, I've done research now, and I've got 12 different numbers from 12 noted authorities that go anywhere as low as 3,600 up to as high as 6,000 milligrams. Basically, what I conclude from that is nobody has a friggin' clue how much iron is in people's body.
Yeah, and I'd say probably the biggest gap there is probably not being able to understand the tissue, because there's almost no way for us, in without being very invasive, to understand what's in the tissue. And I think in these relative excess states, there's probably more, whether it's hemosiderin or these macrophages in tissue, there's probably, and with this variability, a lot more iron being stored in tissue that we can't really quantify very well when we compare it to, hemoglobin in the blood or even myoglobin and muscle.
Right. And that very good point. And what I've been going around and around in circles is trying to figure out what is the difference between blood and tissue. And I think, and I want to run this by you, see what your thoughts are on it. Because I think it's a very real sleight of hand in testing. Blood is really referring to serum. Serum is outside of the red blood cell. And the true tissue that we should be focusing on is the red blood cell. If the red blood cell is 84% of human cells, well, then it dominates human tissue, right?
Correct.
And so isn't the red blood cell tissue under those conditions? If it's considered connective tissue, that's how it's referred to. Red blood cells are connective tissue. So it's like, oh, wait a minute. You mean all this iron that we don't seem to be measuring is found inside the red blood cell because it's found inside the hemoglobin, which is found inside the heme.
Yes. Yeah. It's, I think the one good thing that this module points out is basically describing that, yes, most of the iron is inside of the red blood cell. And even when you start to talk about transferrin and ferritin, some of these other transport molecules, there is very little in the serum. As you just pointed out, blood, this big overarching concept of blood, has so many different components. Most of it is actually this aqueous water. It's kind of a water-based, you know, serum. And so when you look at a traditional complete, you know, blood cell count, a CBC and these other markers, it's looking at that total serum. And yes, as we know, there's very little iron in the serum. And it's not until you do some kind of processing in the lab to essentially lyse and break apart the red blood cells that you can actually look at the content in those cells specifically. And that's where, you know, those tests that some people are probably familiar with that look at, you know, red blood cell folate or red blood cell magnesium. You know, that's coming from inside of the cell. That is not actually in the sort of the soup or the aqueous solution that these cells are bathing in. And there's a huge disconnect, I think, certainly in our sort of teaching, at least when I go back to it, and trying to make sure or trying to delineate and show people there is a huge difference when we talk about tissue and blood. And, you know, we've been using these labs, and really they could only potentially at best be surrogates, associated or correlated surrogates for what might be happening in the tissue. But it's really just, I mean, the body has to have a mechanism for separating the sort of circulatory system, the interstate highway, so to speak, and the tissue. I mean, if these things were, you know, kind of readily able to cross and go into tissue, then we'd be all sorts of out of whack. And so it makes complete sense that there's pretty tight regulation of this interstate highway system and then the exits that are, you know, opened and regulated so that things can get out of that that blood, that serum, and into the tissue when it's supposed to.
When we picture a blood, we see it in a test tube, and it's red. It's red liquid. But all you got to do is spin it down, and suddenly it separates into the red blood cells in the bottom and that aqueous solution on the top. And that we don't think about that when we're looking at the blood in the test tube, but it's actually two parts. And I think the aqueous solution, that's called serum. And if you want to get really technical, if it includes the clotting factors, it's called plasma. That's the difference between plasma and serum. It's just clotting factors. And the red blood cell is not the blood. It's the red blood cell. It's the tissue. Like, oh my gosh, it took me, I've been dancing around that for a couple of years trying to figure out what I am hiding. What's hiding in the red blood cell? And so the focus of conventional medicine is to measure iron in the blood, wink, wink, when in fact it's the serum. It's always in the serum. And what you find out is that there's two proteins that are designed to bind up iron so it stays safe.
Correct.
And you got to have ferritin inside the cell, and you got to have transferrin outside the cell. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Exactly.
And the thing, what most people don't know is that ferritin is supposed to be inside the cell. It's an intracellular protein. It's not supposed to be in the serum. It makes no sense at all. And the thing is that it turns out that there's two forms of ferritin. There's what's called heavy chain and light chain. What's the difference between heavy chain and light chain? Well, the heavy chain has ferrooxidase enzyme function, which is that really pesky but really important enzyme that regulates iron. And so it turns out you can't load iron onto ferritin if you don't have ferrooxidase. And it also turns out you can't unload iron out of ferritin if you don't have ferrooxidase. That's a pretty important thing to know. And so when people are all worked up about their ferritin levels, first of all, it's in the wrong medium, and they have no idea whether it's heavy or light. And then we get into the exciting part of, well, we're measuring ferritin, but we're not measuring hemosiderin. What's the difference? Hemosiderin is just denatured ferritin. Why is that important? Well, what denatured it? It's called hydrogen peroxide. And what happens is as the iron starts to build up in the ferritin, it gives off hydrogen peroxide. And if it gives off too much hydrogen peroxide, it changes the morphological structure and it becomes hemosiderin. And so it changes ferritin, which is basically an ATM machine. It turns it into a bank vault.
Yes.
And it's like, then you can't access it. And that's really important. I think that's pretty important to know, but they don't measure hemosiderin. That would be a really important marker to have. And then the other thing that they don't do is they don't measure inside the red blood cell, we have the hemoglobin made up of heme. Well, hemoglobin is a protein that has a counterpart protein that's an antioxidant. It's called haptoglobin, H-A-P-T-O, globin, haptoglobin.
Correct.
And that's supposed to keep hemoglobin from getting oxidized.
Correct.
And then heme has something called hemopexin, which is another protein that's an antioxidant, to prevent the heme molecule from getting oxidized. And it's like really cool. Haptoglobin, hemopexin, they don't measure either one of those. But then I learned something really important yesterday, that when the process of going from 120 days down to 20 days and the recycling has just been sped up sixfold, well, you burn out the haptoglobin and the hemopexin.
So exactly.
Then the chance for oxidizing the red blood cell goes up astronomically.
Exactly.
And that's where all this chaos starts, right there. That's where it all starts.
It's so fascinating, you know, just sitting here. So we've talked about lots of different proteins and molecules involved in this process. So we'll let people sort of sit with this. And, you know, And looking back at the module that I was presented with in medical school, there is a wonderful picture, a histology slide, describing hemosiderin, which is, as you just said, this, you know, denatured, partially degraded component of ferritin. And it is completely insoluble in water, so it will not be present in blood. And it is, as you said, it turns into a bank vault. It is suddenly now completely inaccessible. And so it is what is stored in those macrophages. So you can actually look on a slide, and if people want to, you can click on in the module, the little box that says hemosiderin, and you will see two different slides of this iron-laden macrophage that has this hemosiderin, and it actually appears sort of golden brown that's in these macrophages. And you can basically detect this in different types of tissue. You know, commonly, it is well understood in iron overload states, such as hemochromatosis, that you can see all of this hemosiderin, these iron-laden macrophages, in the tissues when you do biopsies. And so I would encourage people to come and take a look at that to help them. You know, I'm a visual person, to help see what that looks like. And it's mind-blowing to me too as well when you start to bring in this reticuloendothelial system. Like you said, I think the best way to think about it is a recycling system. And there's a big network in the body, but one of the major organs that's responsible for this recycling is the spleen. So there's also, as you described, a specific set of macrophages in the spleen that are responsible for gobbling up red blood cells when they need to be recycled. So you can almost think about these red blood cells kind of squeezing through the tubes of the spleen. And if their membrane has been deformed in some way, then the macrophage is going, it's going to sort of slow it down enough that the macrophage is going to engulf it and say, oh, that one is, you know, misshapen. It needs to be taken out. And so if there's anything in the body, any process that causes deformation, you know, premature deformation of that membrane, there's going to be, you know, earlier and earlier sequestration. And we know from looking at people with genetic disorders that actually have what is called hereditary spherocytosis, where they have a greater predilection for this sort of turnover, because they're already, you know, their hemoglobin is not quite in the same shape as a normal hemoglobin. It's more of a sphere rather than this kind of oval shape. And so the macrophages more readily will gobble that up. And so the life cycle is less and they get complications. They will get splenomegaly. They can have infarctions of the spleen. And we know too with people with sickle cell anemia, that one of the first things that happens in them early in life is actually this, basically like the spleen kind of gets clogged up because of these deformed red blood cells that the macrophages can basically, it increases, goes beyond their threshold for being able to recycle, and they basically infarct their spleen. So we have to give them medicines to try to protect them, because there's other really important things that the spleen does in terms of an immune organ, and we have to give them protective medicines, and there's other complications that can happen from that. So, you know, looking at some of the outliers, we can see there's a huge role for this recycling. And, you know, the body wants to, it understands how important iron in this heme molecule is. So it wants to recycle. It doesn't want to just let it go through, you know, through the stool and lose it. It understands it needs to be tightly regulated, and it's actually a kind of a precious mineral.
Absolutely agree. And let's back up a step or two about both the spleen and the recycling program. So for the listeners who like to go geek, they want to look up an article by Roger Prohaska. And he was a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And he was an expert on copper. He has a wonderful article. I think it was in the early 90s, like 92, where it's basically looking at spleen metabolism under the conditions of copper deficiency. Basically, the spleen stops working when there's not copper in the body. And Rob, what I think you're going to find as you embrace this mineral metabolism and the foundational importance of minerals is that there's, I believe, a very close connection between copper deficiency and what appears to be a genetic defect.
Yes.
And so I think that we're being trained like circus bears to think that we have gene problems and there's gene defects and, oh, we're screwed for the future because of our genes are broken. Well, they're not broken. They're just not being fed properly. And they do flip, just like circuit breakers flip. And so I think we have to be really mindful of that. But back to your issue of the spherocytes, you know, turning over, what's really clear in the literature is that in order for the red blood cell, it looks like an inner tube, right?
Correct.
Biconical shape. And it's got to be really flexible. The term that's used, the technical term is deformability, which is the most absurd word I've ever heard. Flexibility. And so the red blood cell needs to be looking like an inner tube, and it needs to be flexible so it can get in the capillaries. What gives it the shape and the flexibility? It's called energy, and inside the red blood cell, it's spelled MG-ATP, magnesium ATP. Turns out that the irony is that red blood cell, it's carrying tons and tons of oxygen, but it makes energy anaerobically. Isn't that ironic?
Correct.
And so it's...
Well, maybe let's stop there real quick. Sorry to interrupt, because let's just, you know, it makes sense. So people probably understand that red blood cells do not have mitochondria. They're one of the cells in the body that do not have mitochondria. And it makes perfect sense. What is it carrying? All of this oxygen. What would be the most, you know, horrible thing to have next to these, you know, all of this mitochondria that's creating reactive oxygen species and doing all of this, you know, energy production. So it makes complete sense why the cell doesn't have a mitochondria, because it's strictly carrying oxygen for other purposes. And that would be just a recipe for all. I mean, I picture sort of dynamite and just, you know, throwing gasoline on a fire, whatever analogy you want, but that would just be a recipe for cellular disaster.
Absolutely. And that's, again, that's 84% of our cells. Our anaerobic energy. So what's the head of the stream? It's a 9-step process to create that energy. Well, the very first enzyme is called G6PD, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. What's important to understand about G6PD is it's considered the greatest enzyme deficiency on the planet. Ooh, really? The enzyme that makes energy for the red blood cell is the greatest enzyme deficiency. And you dig and you dig and you dig, and what do you find out? That enzyme has a relationship with both magnesium and copper.
Yes.
Okay? That's pretty important to understand that. So that the enzyme deficiency, and this is true for most enzyme deficiencies, they're not deficiencies, they are dysfunctions, because minerals are missing. And the minerals that are usually missing the most are magnesium and copper, and it's all over the body when this is happening. But if the red blood cell can't make energy properly, it doesn't have the right shape. It doesn't have the right deformability. And the spleen knows it and flags it and says, get rid of this thing. We got to get it offline. And it's all because of a lack of energy, because of a lack of minerals to run the head of the stream enzyme. And so now we have this tension. I mean, I did a post just yesterday about all this red blood cell activity, and there was a person who wrote in and said, but my husband has spherocyte, whatever you called it.
Yeah, spherocytosis.
And what did I do? I went to Dr. Google, and I put up spherocytosis magnesium deficiency, and bingo bongo was a study from like 2014 that explained, well, actually it's a magnesium issue, not a genetic issue. And so people have got to understand that they can solve most of their problems if they would just eat better food and spend a lot less time researching websites that want to throw labels around and make people think like they're broken, because they're not broken. They're just not nourished. That's the problem.
Yeah. You know, I see, as you just described, you know, we get so stuck on the genetic, you know, defects or even the SNP, this, you know, single nucleotide polymorphism that destines us to forever, you know, having a condition. And, you know, I see it as, you know, whether it's MTHFR or G6PD, or even this hereditary spherocytosis, these various, you know, differences in the genetic code that seem to be predisposing or causing a certain condition. It's nice to know that information because it'll probably inform you that you have a different requirement in order to try to regain normal functioning. So, you know, with MTHFR, classically, we're starting to understand, you know, those specific alleles are related to work capacity of that enzyme. It's not like you're destined to have no methylated folate. You'll probably just have to have a different combination of minerals and perhaps some other downstream metabolites to help alleviate that decreased workload capacity. And the same, you know, idea goes for some of these even more propounded or genetic diseases, G6PD, hereditary spherocytosis, is those individuals probably going to need a different type of supplementation and nutrition to, you know, maintain that magnesium and copper balance because of that, you know, predisposition to having a deformed red blood cell or a red blood cell that's not able to make enough energy properly. And it's fascinating. You know, we are certainly taught that with regards to G6PD, you know, there's certain regions, you know, the Mediterranean region and other regions where this is more common. And I think the joke, and hopefully I'm not, you know, butchering this, but one of the things we also learn is that common oxidants will be the things that can put someone into kind of a crisis related to G6PD. And the common one that we're taught is fava beans because of this sort of oxidative stress. And so I just think about, well, what are all the things in our lives that are creating this sort of excess oxidative burden? Well, there, you can list about a million things. And so if we can take off that burden of oxidative stress and supplement and provide these other nutrients, these other minerals, you know, magnesium, copper, what have you, you know, zinc, to help those individuals, there's a possibility that, yeah, they could have almost nearly normal functioning red blood cells.
Yeah, and I think what people need to understand is that Where is, you know, you're referring to, you know, hundreds of different forms of oxidative stress. There's superoxide, and there's hydrogen peroxide, and there's the hydroxyl radical, and one begets the other. So superoxide gets neutralized by SOD, superoxide dismutase, is a silly way of saying neutralized. So superoxide becomes hydrogen peroxide, and then hydrogen peroxide, when it mixes, particularly with iron, ding, 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 becomes the hydroxyl radical, which is the most violent biomolecule in the human body, or on the planet, actually. It is the sine qua non for creating chaos inside the gene, and where are 100 times more gene problems? Is it in the nucleus or in the mitochondria? Turns out it's in the mitochondria. Right. And so why is that significant? Because where is this oxidative stress occurring? It's occurring inside the mitochondria because the complex 1, 3, and 4 aren't able to work properly. Why? Because they don't have enough bioavailable copper and they don't have the right B vitamins, the right forms. And people need to understand that, that these really important energy furnaces need minerals and nutrients in order to work properly. What's particularly important for that series of complexes to work is a fat called cardiolipin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's a really important fat that has basically been decimated by a low-fat diet. Oh, and there's also this thing called CoQ10, ubiquinone. That's pretty important. That's been decimated by statins. And what is ubiquinone doing? It's shuttling between 1, 3, and 4
Correct.
To carry electrons. And it's like, you know what it is? It's an antioxidant. That's what ubiquinone is. It's like it has been so twisted and distorted. People don't understand how important these little electrons are inside the mitochondria. That's all we are is electrons. We are reduction and oxidation, back and forth.
Correct.
Electrons there. And if the handoffs don't work right, guess what happens? They end up on oxygen and it becomes an oxidant that then has to be antioxidant. It's got to be neutralized. And if it's not with the scavengers, A, C, and E, then it's got to be the enzymes, either superoxide dismutase or catalase or glutathione peroxidase or the granddaddy of them all, ferrooxidase. That when there's enough ferrooxidase in the human body, you don't have a lot of this chaos. That's the irony of it. And I would contend that the missing piece of the puzzle in all of this discussion about ascorbic acid versus whole food vitamin C is there's silence about the fact that in the plant world, there's an enzyme called ascorbate oxidase. Well, there's code. Anytime you see the word oxidase, you know that copper is involved in it. Why is that? Because copper is the only mineral that can work with oxygen without causing rust. Copper activates oxygen. Copper enables oxygen to engage in what's called respiration so that we can actually make energy. Iron doesn't do that. Manganese doesn't do that. Magnesium doesn't do that. Copper is the only mineral that can work with oxygen, and thank goodness it does, because we wouldn't have life on this planet if there were no copper, because we would all have rusted out by now. And that is completely lost, and not even, there's no hint of the importance of copper on your pathology tutorial. And why is it important? Well, you can't make the He molecule without bioavailable copper. You can't insert the iron atom into the He molecule without a key enzyme called ferrochelatase, which runs on bioavailable copper. You can't knit four heme together to make hemoglobin unless you have bioavailable copper. And so then the whole life cycle is regulated by a key enzyme called heme oxygenase 1, and it keys off of copper status.
Yes.
So that when copper goes down, heme oxygenase goes up, and then you have more turnover. Because what is heme oxygenase doing? It's lysing, it's cutting up the hemoglobin and turning it into carbon dioxide, biliverdin, and iron. And then that biliverdin becomes bilirubin. And I, for most of my life, had high bilirubin. No one ever told me why. My internist for 25 years said, your bilirubin is kind of elevated. You're not taking any multis with iron, are you? I said, no. He never told me what the connection was between iron and bilirubin. Would have been nice to know. But my bilirubin didn't get normal until I donated blood on a bi-monthly basis. And when I donate blood every other month, I don't have elevated bilirubin. And I don't have the oxidative stress because my body has the right amount of iron in it because it's regulating itself with regular blood donations. And that's what any guy of any age should be doing. Anyone over the age of 21 should, any guy should be donating blood on a quarterly basis for the rest of their life. And any woman who's cycling should be doing it twice a year on her birthday and 6 months from her birthday. And when she goes into menopause, she should be working just like a man every quarter, because that process of releasing blood vitalizes the whole process of making new red blood cells, which is really important. And it supercharges the whole system of recycling. So people need to know that there's a very simple procedure that they can do, and it will change your your blood chemistry. It'll bring it back into regulation. Your cholesterol, all the hyperlipidemia that people are struggling with, it all becomes of excess iron in their blood from excess iron in their diet. That's where all this iron is coming from, and there's no mention of that in this pathology thread.
Yeah.
It's completely silent on the fact that there's just too much iron in our system.
Yeah. Wow. So much there. We've had such a great discussion so far with the science and getting to the cellular level. And I am just blown away time and time again with the depth of your research. And I really hope people are enjoying this so far. And I think, you know, that last comment, you know, I'd love to spend the last, you know, 15 minutes or so getting perhaps a little more practical for folks in terms of these, you know, dietary sources of iron. And maybe we'll end up getting to sort of a stopping point with this conversation that will be a good lead into, you know, part three. But I, on my sort of spare time last night, got really into the weeds of looking at, well, what really is in our diet when it comes to these minerals? And everyone knows, it's very common knowledge now, that with this sort of overall depletion of the soil because of sort of non-sustainable farming practices and just all the phosphorus, I mean, we could go into tons of detail there, but essentially the soil today is not the same as it was 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And so guess what? What gets put into plants? What gets put into, you know, animal cells? Well, it's all based off the what's in the soil. And so, you know, one of the things that our country did a little while back to try to circumvent some of this was begin fortification. One of the things that we did was start to refine flour and then add iron to that flour, because as you had mentioned in previous conversations, you know, iron deficiency anemia was this big, huge epidemic, supposedly, and the best way to fix that was, well, let's put iron in the most common foods and tell people to eat it. So, you know, estimates now of people eating sort of a standard American diet will get around 10 to 15 milligrams of iron a day. Now, people are also probably familiar with, well, I've heard about non-heme iron and heme iron being, you know, more absorbed. And I hope, you know, I talked to a lot of people, well, do you know what heme versus non-heme even means? And I think we've made it pretty clear here, but heme iron is just referring to hemoglobin. So iron in the hemoglobin structure attached to these heme molecules, which, guess what, is only in animal products. It is a molecule in animals. Plants do not have hemoglobin. They have chlorophyll, which, interestingly enough, is a very similar structure, but in the center of that molecule, of that structure, is actually magnesium. So non-heme iron is essentially iron predominantly from these plant sources. There is a little bit in animal sources, but you cannot get heme iron from plant sources because it requires hemoglobin. And yes, we can better absorb the iron attached to heme at the enterocyte barrier than we can non-heme. So this whole discussion of, you know, non-heme versus heme iron, well, it just comes down to it's hemoglobin. And where is it coming from? Animal tissue. So I wanted to put that aside because that sort of bugged me for a little while. And I had some struggles with trying to understand what the heck was non-heme versus heme iron. But so we have these different potential dietary sources. One can be more readily absorbed than the other because of its because of iron's construct, either its oxidative state or its connection with the heme molecule. And so I wanted to look in, well, what's the difference between, say, one of these fortified grains and something that we pretty commonly understand to have iron? Red meat. So I looked, and there's, like I said, there's some variation in this because all animals and all soils are not equal, but a 100 gram amount of grass-fed beef contains about 1.75 to 2 milligrams of iron. Now, no one really eats just 100 grams of grass-fed beef, so I did a calculation and said, well, let's take a 6-ounce steak. That's about 170 grams. So, you know, roughly that's, when you do the math, 3.4, 3.5 milligrams of iron in that serving. Now, if you got really excited and, man, I'm going to eat a whole pound of grass-fed beef, I'm going to eat a pound of meat, even that gets you up to, you know, 450 grams of the beef or 9 milligrams of this heme iron. Well, how much copper is in the same amount of tissue? So 100 grams of grass-fed beef has about 0.1 milligrams. So if we go to that ratio, we can see, you know, there is about, for a 100 gram source of grass-fed beef, about 2 milligrams of iron to 0.1 milligrams of copper. So that gives you your ratio of sort of iron to copper in muscle meat and grass-fed beef. Now, let's compare that to Cheerios. I just happened to pick one of the cereals that is fortified with this, you know, refined flour and iron. Interestingly enough, I had no idea. So in 1 cup of Cheerios, which realistically, who eats only 1 cup of Cheerios? There is 4.5 milligrams of iron. Now, I'd say, now let's increase that to 2 cups, because like I said, who really eats 1 cup of Cheerios? And 2 cups of Cheerios, there are 9 milligrams of iron. Going back to our discussion, well, what form of iron is this? And, you know, it certainly can't be heme iron, because it's not an animal product. And when you dig into the literature and look at, well, what is actually put into breakfast cereals, we've talked about this entire time, well, iron loves to be oxidized. Right? It loves to interact with oxygen. So a breakfast cereal, once it's opened out of the package, is going to suddenly be interacting with iron. So the manufacturers cannot put it in a form that is very readily oxidized with iron. Otherwise, that cereal is going to go bad quite quickly. And so it ends up being sort of created in a form that's not really readily water-soluble, and it is probably one of the most the least bioavailable forms is this type of iron that is used in these fortified cereals. And so, you know, you start to see when you compare these products, you know, in Cheerios, so I looked up, well, how much copper is in this? And it's about the same, 0.1 milligrams, so about the same amount of copper in 1 cup of Cheerios as there is in that serving of grass-fed beef. So you go back and look at the ratios, and it doesn't take a, you know, math whiz to say, well, in 1 cup of Cheerios, that's 4.5 milligrams of iron to 0.1 milligrams of copper. There's only 1.75 to 2 milligrams of much more bioavailable iron in that steak. So what is that a recipe for? Well, that sounds like to me, there's going to be a ton of non-bioavailable iron that's going to go through the small intestine when you eat, you know, Cheerios, and it's going to make its way to the large intestine. And the large intestine isn't really equipped to handle large amounts of iron. When you start to look at all of the other foods that we eat and the amount of iron that is being sort of delivered beyond the small intestine, the duodenum, where iron is being absorbed, we're not talking about massive amounts. But when you suddenly look at fortified foods with this minimally bioavailable iron, and then start to throw in, oh my goodness, supplements for people who are iron deficient, suddenly there is this massive load of iron reaching the colon. And what's going to happen once it gets there? Well, guess what it's going to interact with? The gut microbes, the immune system, the, you know, the colonic cells lining our that are basically in direct context with this excess intraluminal iron. And so big introduction. All of that, like I said, I kind of nerded out last night because I wanted to get your thoughts on ultimately what are the harms of this huge excess of intraluminal iron that's making its way to the colon because it's so minimally absorbed, so it's minimally bioavailable, and it's just constantly getting put down our throats in the forms of supplements and fortified foods.
Yeah, no, it's a great assessment of what's found in the typical diet. My college roommate used to love to snack on cereal. And Cheerios was his favorite. Well, his ferritin got to be in the 700s. The irony is, his grandfather, father, and wife were physicians, and they never thought to test his ferritin level. And he was really getting run down because of the excess iron. Again, that was the ferritin showing up in his serum blood where it's not supposed to be. It's there because the liver is breaking down. So the thing is, I think what's really glaring in this whole issue of do we need more iron, or how do we deal with that? How do we balance it with the copper? The metrics that we're using are abysmal. Absolutely abysmal. Because, first of all, most conventional blood tests to measure iron are in the serum, which is ignoring the red blood cell, which is 84% of the human body. So that's a significant defect. And I think what we've also got to get past is this idea, the mindset of most people is that they are anemic, or that they have iron poor blood. And what people need to understand is that that is based on flawed technology, because the issue is not what is my iron status. The real question is what is my iron homeostasis? And iron homeostasis has three parts. It's a seesaw. There's a four-year-old on one end of the seesaw. That's iron in the blood. And there's a sumo wrestler at the other end of the seesaw, and that's iron in your tissue. And when the sumo wrestler sits on the seesaw, guess what happens? The four-year-old goes flying up into the air, holding on for dear life. What the limitation of conventional labs is, they put a spotlight on the four-year-old, and they ignore the sumo wrestler, and they ignore the fulcrum. Well, what's the fulcrum? That's the ferrooxidase enzyme that shuttles iron from blood to tissue and back again. And if you don't have ferrooxidase enzyme, the iron can't get out of the enterocytes. And if it can't get out of the enterocytes, it's only going to invite oxidation or the prevalence of pathogens. What do all pathogens live on? They live on iron, thank you very much. Whether they're bacteria, fungus, virus, or parasites, they all thrive on an iron buffet. So if there's an iron buffet in the gut, they're just happy as clams. And so then that gut dysbiosis isn't a disease. It's an energetic breakdown of the tight junction connections that are supposed to be, that there's a magnetic attraction between these cells inside our gut. Well, as the iron builds up in the enterocytes, the magnetism begins to weaken. It's ironic. You'd think it would be just the opposite, but it's the inverse, and the cells begin to come apart, and then that's how the food particles, proteins, and other nutrients get through the gut into the bloodstream to cause the allergic reaction. And so then you've got a histamine crisis on your hands. And it doesn't take long to see what the reach of histamine intolerance is for just about every cell in the body. If you can't regulate histamines, you got a world of hurt. And what's another name for ferrooxidase? It's also called histaminase. Ding, ding, ding. So it turns out that this ferrooxidase enzyme regulates histamines. That's pretty important to know. And apparently there are not many gastroenterologists that know that, but that's an important thing to know. And then we've got to deal with the fact that another site of iron buildup is in the hepatocytes, and those are the liver cells. And again, the iron needs to be able to get out of the cell so it can be part of the recycling system. And if it can't get out of the enterocyte, if it can't get out of the hepatocyte, if it can't get out of the macrophage, if it can't get out of the red blood cell, then that's where all the problems are occurring, because iron has become a storage mineral and metal instead of a recycled metal. So we have these breakdowns in our awareness, is that iron, it is a heavy metal. And all we need each day is 1 milligram of iron a day. I didn't make that up. That's from Robert Crichton, who's one of the world's authorities on iron. And one of your textbooks was probably from Robert Crichton. Rob, I don't know that for a fact, but he's in his fourth edition now. He's considered the world's authority on iron. And I was talking with him just a couple months ago. It was about almost 8 weeks ago. And he said that the razor's edge of iron is you only need 1 milligram a day. And most people think they need 20 to 30 or more. And when doctors give people supplements, they might give as many as 250 milligrams a day. People are being completely overwhelmed with iron. Yes. And if you don't have bioavailable copper, also known as ferrooxidase enzyme, then that iron gets stored because in a body that has low copper, the mammalian physiology is wired that if there isn't enough copper, we store iron, period. Where does it store it first and foremost? Always in the liver. Then it starts to store it in the organs around the liver. Then it goes to the kidney. Then it goes into the endocrine glands. And then it goes into the joints. And as we age, it goes into the brain. And that's what the source of all neurodegeneration is. And so we have to get past the mindset that people have that they are anemic and copper toxic. We have to get past the mindset that iron is supposed to be stored in ferritin, but they're measuring it in an extracellular medium. We have to get past the fact that most people have never heard of the ferrooxidase enzyme. And we have to get past the fact that most people don't realize that the production of energy and the neutralization of excess iron and the oxidants that it creates are all based on the energy of bioavailable copper. That's not taught. It's not taught in medical school. It's not taught in nursing school. It's not taught on the internet. It's not taught anywhere. Why? Because it kills the business model of big pharma. And what people need to understand is that this whole paradigm of sick people has really flourished just in the last 100 years. Our great-grandparents weren't sick like we are today. They had real food, and they didn't have iron fortification, and they didn't have toxic herbicides and GMO seeds that were causing devastation to the mineral balance in our body. They've lost an aptitude for how much the environment has changed, how much the soil has changed, how much farming has changed, how much the food system has changed, how much the pharmaceutical system has changed. And our bodies have changed in reaction to all of those changes that I've just enumerated. And how could we expect to be in balance if they've made all those other changes?
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, I think.
When you think of all of the potential inputs to disrupt this amazing symphony from, GMOs and destruction of the normal soil balance to, the fortification of foods with iron. I even say, the fortification of foods with sugar. I think added sugar is just another form of this sort of bizarre fortification, increased prevalence of certain pharmaceuticals. It's when you start to think of all the inputs that have been created just in the last, 100 years within generations, it's incredible. And then, lay that on top of all the other chemicals and toxic exposures that we're exposed to on a regular basis, it's mind-boggling. And when you start to see these systems interconnecting, I've started to generate, trying to generate anyway, some sort of simplified model to incorporate all of these ideas. And I keep coming back to what is the first thing going wrong, or what are the first systems that are being disrupted? And I see it as this this cellular energy metabolism and its interplay with these minerals, and then that leading to immune dysregulation. And we've I think articulated pretty well here what can this idea of gut dysbiosis and all of these diseases of immune dysfunction, whether it's allergies or asthma, actually probably first starts with some degree of, you know, cellular dysfunction metabolically because of these because of this imbalance between these key minerals. And I just think about, as you mentioned, there's numerous cells that we could take apart from here that are integral to the body. But you mentioned the hepatocyte, you mentioned the enterocyte, you mentioned the macrophage. And if they're all being laden with iron and basically being made into storage cells that are non-functional, they can't do the other functions they've been created to do, which, guess what? The enterocyte is meant to absorb and regulate that's our intestinal barrier. It's meant to maintain those tight junctions, and it's meant to absorb other nutrients. It's meant to interact with the immune system. The macrophage is a cell in the immune system, and it's actually one of the key cells in both the innate response to pathogens as well as an antigen presenting cell, presenting the things that are being taken up from the external environment and presented to the immune system. And I had a great discussion with McKay Rippey with his podcast talking about, you know, this new theory of, in my mind, you know, this immune system inflexibility, this inflexibility of the immune system to sort of switch between different types of immune responses, whether it's a cellular response or an antibody response. And underlying that, I see disruption in antigen presentation, whether it's a macrophage or a dendritic cell. And all of these cells are primarily located along the gut lining, because that is one of our major barriers to the external world. So if a macrophage is loaded with iron, I don't see how it's going to function well as an antigen presenting cell or as a phagocyte taking up bacteria. If a hepatocyte is laden with iron, I don't see how it's going to be able to do all the, you know, the other cellular processes of creating, you know, gluconeogenesis and drug detoxification, phase one, phase two, and then the enterocyte, as we mentioned, and then coming all the way back to the red blood cell. If it doesn't have its, you know, proper amount of hemoglobin or regulation of hemoglobin, then we're not getting oxygen to the body. If the red blood cell is dysfunctional, its main job is getting oxygen to the other cells of the body. And if it cannot do that, if we have impaired oxygen deliverability, whether that's from not just simply not having enough of the cells or having dysfunctional cells, guess what? The body is going to break down. And so it's just, to me, it's insane when you start to see how all this, you know, comes back to some very key root causes, and it will forever remain multifactorial. It's a complex system that we probably will never be able to, you know, fully describe in the same way we can describe a complicated motor engine. But when we start to open our minds to these connections, to the interplay of these minerals with the immune system and our own mind psychology, it becomes fascinating to see how this is playing a role in I would argue, in nearly every disease state. And I know too, this has probably been a touch negative. It seems like a little sort of, we've been talking about all of this from a perspective that seems a little scary. So I wanted to get, at least now, to close the podcast, any of your final thoughts. And if you're able to, at least leave us with a little sort of optimistic, positive hope.
I'll do my best. So, I think Mark Hyman has the great definition for stress. Stress is the body's inability to make energy for the mind to respond to its environment.
Ooh, damn. I like that.
It's a wonderful definition. I think he has moments of brilliance, which I really, really respect. But what does that mean? It means the body can't make enough energy. And what happens is when we are under stress, and we're all under stress, life on planet Earth is stressful, but when we're under stress, what's the price we pay? We always have to give up energy. Always have to give up energy. And how's that energy molecule spelled inside the cell? Magnesium hyphen ATP. And when you give up energy, you lose magnesium. So that's where the magnesium loss is under stress. You'll see it all over the place. Oh, you know, when you're under stress, you're going to lose magnesium. That's a really important thing to understand. Why? Because magnesium is involved in 3,751 enzymes. That's a lot of enzymes to keep track of. And so the important thing for people to realize is, yes, the human body is complex, but I don't think it's complicated. I really don't. There are a lot of moving parts, no question about it. But when you account for the movement of magnesium and copper and properly regulated iron, the human body hums. It has a frequency, and it has the right frequency when those three minerals are in balance, because the enzymes attached to those three minerals are going to be in balance too. And so by way of hope, you know, I have a solution for all this. It is called the root cause protocol. It's been developing over the last several years, but it's been the last year that it's really been formalized and codified. And there's a series of things to stop doing, which would at the head of that list of things to stop doing is stop taking vitamin D. Maybe that can be a conversation for us to have a future conversation, Rob. But supplemental D is poison in the human body. And so is supplemental calcium, supplemental iron, and supplemental zinc. Those are the top four things that I have people stop doing in order to stop the confusion and chaos of the system. But the protocol has about 12 or 13 different parts, and it's a very easy thing to do, and it's laid out, again, on that either mygotmag.org or on the rootcauseprotocol.com, and people can begin to let go of those things to stop. They can just stop doing those things, and they can start to embrace things that will begin to revitalize them. And what does that include? Mineral drops in water, taking magnesium, taking vitamin C, taking cod liver oil, taking the right kind of B vitamins. If it's coming out of a bottle, you don't use it. You want it to come from Mother Nature. So bee pollen, rice bran, beef liver, things like that. And there are a handful of other factors. But the important thing is people need to embrace the unbelievable power and majesty of these minerals, especially when they are in food-based forms.
Yes, that point. I want to interrupt you just for 1 second. I was blown away. Sorry for that interruption. I was blown away when I first saw the root cause protocol that so much of it is food or food-based, you know, supplements and changing things about your lifestyle. It's actually removing, you know, potentially a degree of supplements and replacing things with almost entirely food-based products, which, you know, to me, that's a huge yes, yes, yes. There's probably a lot of legitimacy or at least some hope with that instead of, you know, someone in this space, and I don't want to, you know, name names, but going and pointing out that there's certain deficiencies and then making a supplement to correct for that deficiency. Much of what's on the protocol, and I encourage people to look at it, is food-based. As you mentioned, beef liver or desiccated liver capsules, bee pollen, different forms of magnesium, and it's just cod liver oil. When you look at it, you're like, oh, that's a food. Oh, that's a food. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that when you look at that, it's like, this actually seems pretty reasonable because it's almost all coming from food-based sources.
Yeah, and that was its intent, was to try to make it simple. And there, you know, there are people all over the planet doing that protocol. Many of them are people I've never even talked with, but I get these glowing testimonials, people thanking me for saving their life, people thanking me for getting their thyroid to work right. I don't even know who these people are, but all they're doing is following this protocol. So I would encourage people to step away from their label, step away from the mythology around that label, especially the genetic label,
yes,
the gene defect label, and begin to realize that in a body that is being fed properly with real food and being nourished properly with the right minerals and vitamins, the body knows exactly what to do to keep you in balance.
Yes.
And you know, no offense, Rob, but your goal should be to nourish people as much as you can so you don't have very many patients.
Exactly.
That's kind of the place of your business model, but it's like, that's really what the frontline practitioners need to be doing is feeding people and educating people about how the body works and making sure they're getting the right nutrients so that they don't become participants in the lobby of your office.
Yeah.
That's the last place you want them to be.
Yeah. Morley, thank you again so much for sharing this conversation on the heels of Christmas. I'm just so grateful that I've had you on the show to hear so much of your wisdom and experience in this. I mean, I think we both have to be honest. We're, you know, simply curious, trying to figure this one out. Do we have all the answers yet? By no means. Are we on to something? I truly believe so. It just, it's something that drives me every day. And I'm just, like I said, so fortunate that you have shared this. And I hope people really enjoy this discussion and everything that we've, you know, talked about here. So thank you again, Morley.
Delighted to spend the time with you. And like I said, I'll lay down the gauntlet. Let's make the next conversation about vitamin D. And I'll invite you to look up the word Soltriol, S-O-L-T-R-I-O-L. And you're going to discover that that hormone, it's actually the oldest hormone on the planet. It's the most powerful hormone in the human body, has been hijacked. And look up the research of a physician named Stumpf, S-T-U-M-P, F as in Frank. S-T-U-M-P as in Peter, F as in Frank. And I think your jaw is going to drop, and then we're going to have a very interesting conversation.
Oh, I'm ready for it. The new year is beckoning, and I will dig into this wholeheartedly. So, well, thanks, Morley. You have a wonderful new year. And until next time, be well, my friend.
You as well. And with that added stress of nights, make sure you're taking plenty of magnesium, okay?
Oh, I've upped it. Let's put it that way. It is in my water.
All right. Well, have a great one. And I look forward to catching up with you in the new year.
Sounds good. Thanks, Morley.
Thank you for your presence and willingness to receive a new narrative, a passionate perspective, and perhaps a deeper sense of connection with our collective purpose. Please share this podcast with any and all that you believe will benefit from its intention to relieve one's doing and engage one's being. Please share your comments about the conversation on our podcast page and leave a review in iTunes so that the voices in this space can spread to all ears ready to receive it. Music credit goes to Dillingham for their song Vessel. Remain open, stay curious, and forever be love.
You walked on fire, and I know you tried.